This is the Takeaway Podcast for Memorial Day, Monday, May 30th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening and happy Memorial Day. We will help you amaze your friends with the Veep Stakes speculation about who might end up as running mates for whoever might end up as nominees in this year's presidential race. And we'll have speculation about what the very much foreshortened U.S. Supreme Court will rule on between now and its recess later on in the summer.
Order! Right shoulder.
The Marine Max Memorial Day weekend try it and buy it sales event. This weekend, you can buy the boat of your dreams and enjoy it this summer and beyond. Visit Marine Max.
Beautiful blue skies, lots of sun, 72 on Saturday, and 78.
Here's the grill master for today.
No. The guy that's grilling. There's a difference.
Got the burgers on.
Got burger hands, too.
But first, on days like these, we claim we can begin with the power of memory and national unity to somehow understand the cost of war. And each year, with the smell of barbecue and sunscreen wafting around our heads, heralding the cultural beginnings of summer, we seem to lose our way. Officially, Memorial Day is a day to recognize America's war dead, all 651,000 of them, approximately, at least according to the official count. Veterans Day later this year is an opportunity to honor the roughly 42 million Americans who have served in the military from the earliest days of this nation. But what about the wounded? What of them? Technically, they are veterans. But ought there be a day set aside for the wounded?
I honestly, yes, I do believe there should be. There's a lot of wounded warriors in this country, and they've sacrificed just as much. And in a sense, soldiers who have been wounded have lost a bit of their self, and they're not the same person inside. So in a sense, they have died too. So it'd be great if the country honored wounded warriors.
Meet Iraq veteran Kevin Snow. We will hear the challenges he and his wife have faced together and how they speak to us of all the enduring costs of war in our time.
I think if you want to know the war, look at the wound that it inflicts.
Dr. Emily Mayhew is a historian in residence in the Department of Bioengineering at the Imperial College in London.
Look at the wound, look at the response, look at the treatment, and look at the outcomes in the short and the medium and the long term, because that really is what war means.
She's written a book chronicling the entire story of World War I, the so-called Great War, from the perspective of the wounded and the medics of that war. It's the first time it's ever been done. Thanks to critical changes in how doctors, nurses, and stretcher bearers in the field cared for the wounded, each war since World War I has sent a greater and greater number of wounded soldiers back home. Fewer British soldiers, for instance, died from battlefield injuries and sickness during World War I than in any previous war. That means that slowly, over the past century, it is not the long rows of graves in cemeteries that best signify the sacrifices our society has made to war, perhaps, but the people living and hurting among us. Dr. Mayhew says those wounded bodies carry the sacrifice every day, and they are young men and women today, which means they will be living with us in our communities for a long time to come.
One of the most moving things I ever read about was a young doctor, a young general practitioner who was considered one of the best doctors on the front. And he made sure that every time reinforcements arrived in his trenches, that he went out and he met every single one of them that came. And he shook their hand and he looked them in the eye and he repeated their name, because it was incredibly important for morale that they felt that the doctor had noticed them. So that if they went out and they fell while they were fighting, that somebody knew to look for them, that they were lost, but that they would be found.
How about the wounded? Did they speak? Do they speak in this war, and do they have a voice?
In the 1980s, our Imperial War Museum went round and took sound archives. They went round with a tape recorder, and they went and recorded people who were really the last generation to survive the Great War. So sometimes you hear them speaking in their own voice, and the detail that they remember, such as when they were hit by the shell, they lose effectively all their possessions. One of them remembered going back in an ambulance train, and all he had was a pair of pajamas and a borrowed jacket to keep him warm. And that was all really that he had left in the world. And so when he went to the hospital, he felt almost as if he was being reborn again. And he was going to have to reconnect with his family and reconnect with his life without any of the encumbrances of fighting in the war. But generally, they're relieved and confident. I think this is an interesting, it's always an interesting thing to observe. They're very confident in the medical services because they know that they will be found. And when they're going to be found, they're going to be treated as well as they possibly could be. And indeed, by probably 1916, if you had an abdominal injury, the best place to go wasn't a hospital in London, it was a hospital on the Western Front.
What about their injuries that they were taking back home with them, the limb losses, the sense of being incomplete in some way?
Absolutely. And this is something that, again, has very strong resonance for today. We're good at dealing with injuries on the field. We're good at dealing with them in the short and the medium term. But the long term, where people come home, and in Britain, we had 41,000 amputees. And that was Britain. It was closer to 100,000 in France and in Germany, and several thousand in the soldiers in the United States returning. And they returned to a world that very quickly forgot why they got the injury. So they weren't only dealing with a difficult and forgetful social environment, but they had physical consequences of their injury that they lived with forever. They had pain in their stump, and then they had this dreadful condition that we still see today with pretty much everyone who has an amputation, what we call the phantom limb syndrome. I always think of it of people returning from the war, not only with their injury, but with a ghost that came with them.
And you're looking at some of the same kinds of things in Afghanistan. We have so much technology that we bring into the battlefield. Our ability to save people on the point of injury is superior, better than it's ever been. What's similar, though, in the ways in which people are treated in Afghanistan and presumably Iraq is similar? And how does it compare to what went on in World War I?
Well, the principle that underlines military medicine in both our countries was really formulated in the First World War, and it goes back to this idea of stopping the bleed. If you can stop the bleed, you can save the person and make them stronger for the next stage of their journey. And we call that the golden hour now. So we take out as expert people as we can get, and we take them out to the point of wounding. In the First World War, that was a stretcher bearer with some dressings and training in the control of hemorrhage. But now it's your Pedro service and our Mert service. And it has people on board who can bring people back from points of wounding, from points so close to death that we didn't realize they even existed. So the principles are the same. And the injuries, by and large, are the same. You're still looking at problems with limb loss. Now we have multiple limb loss. It was rare to survive a double amputation in the First World War. Now a triple amputation is the norm in both our countries as a result of the kinds of warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan. But those problems in the medium and in the long term, we still have very little resolution. There are still ghosts coming back from warfare. People are still coming back with their phantoms. We don't know how to deal with that, and we don't know how to deal with the pain.
If a doctor from World War I showed up in one of the medical facilities in Afghanistan, would he or she know exactly what to do?
He would know exactly what to do. I think, and it would work the other way. I think if you took today's surgeons back to the forward surgical units in the First World War, it would be pretty much the same thing. Better scanners and much better anaesthetics. The only thing that's really changed significantly is the quality of the anaesthetics. But otherwise, the pressure of work, the need to do damage control surgery, so you're not just saving a limb, you're taking off a limb to save a life. They would recognize those fundamental principles at once. I looked at a diary the other day from a friend of mine who works in my department, and I could take out the word Afghanistan and put in the word Somme, and it would be pretty much the same thing.
That's amazing. The synthetic blood that they have today is a transformative technological feature of the modern emergency room in the battlefield, yes?
Probably the two most significant things that you would notice today are the tourniquets that everybody carries and also the hemostatic dressings. So this idea of not bleeding to death, it's not just a question of a medic helping you with that. You can do it yourself. Keep yourself alive until the medic comes. But again, it's all the same principle. It all comes down to blood, I'm afraid.
What about the brain injuries? The brain injuries were very... were often fatal in World War I. not so much the case today. What are you seeing, and how is that an emblem of modern warfare?
I think that's absolutely the case. If you had a brain injury in World War One, the chances are you were going to die. You were going to die slowly and probably noisily, so you were going to affect the ward around you. People dreaded patients coming in with brain injury because there would be a lot of screaming and a lot of crying, and it would disrupt and upset the other patients because everybody knew it was going the wrong way. We're still not as good at brain injuries as you think, as you might think we were after a century. We've got extremely good scans. We can do a lot of forward surgery on brains, but the long-term outcomes are still difficult. And we're still not entirely sure always what we're dealing with. I talk to people and they talk about brain injury. They talk about mild concussion, and then they talk about PTSD. And nobody's quite sure where the boundaries are. So in a way, I think one of the most important things to establish will be some really clear diagnostic boundaries so that months or even years after the injury, we know exactly what we're dealing with.
As I was reading this book, I got the feeling that perhaps the perspective of the wounded and the medics in a war offers the best testimony to what was sacrificed in that war, that the cost of the war is best told in these voices. Do you think that's the case?
I do, John, and that makes you the perfect reader because that's very much the message that I have in my work. I think if you want to know the war, look at the wound that it inflicts. Look at the wound, look at the response, look at the treatment, and look at the outcomes in the short and the medium and the long term, because that really is what war means. The geopolitics fall away. What it's about is the damage that is done to human beings.
Dr. Emily Mayhew is a historian in residence in the Department of Bioengineering at the Imperial College in London. She's the author of Wounded. Dr. Mayhew, thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed, John.
What the wounded speak of about their wartime experiences is different from what the generals say, different from the reporters, the enemy. When a soldier goes to war, a family goes with him or her. When they return, an entire family must heal from battlefield wounds. Adrian, wife of Staff Sergeant Kevin Snow, had a lot of healing to do.
When he came back, I just wanted my life back to the way it was before he left. He was fun. He laughed about the silliest things. He would play with the kids. Now we can't be loud around Dad because it, you know, makes Daddy nervous.
What makes you nervous, Kevin?
Crowds. Just, you know, not being able to see. I have to be in an open space. It can't be a closed space. You know, when my anxiety gets really bad, it triggers the memories and, you know, puts me in an uncomfortable situation. I become really irritated. I start yelling, and, you know, a lot of times I have to learn that I'm not back in Iraq. I have to tell myself that repeatedly.
Coming up, more with Staff Sergeant Kevin Snow and his wife, Adrian.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, with packing, shipping, and moving supplies for both business and personal needs 7 days a week. Learn more at staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And now we will spend a little time with Staff Sergeant Kevin Snow and his wife, Adrian, from Philadelphia. Kevin deployed in Iraq for two tours, was injured when a grenade exploded on his base. He lives with a traumatic brain injury and multiple anxiety disorders. Kevin and Adrian and their five kids are a heroic platoon, taking on a mission that you really have to look to see in your own community. But it's there.
I'll never get who I was back. I've come to a realization that I'll never be who I once was. That part of me has died in Iraq. You know, at first I didn't accept it, and I did everything I could to try to, you know, get the old me back. And when I first came back from Iraq, I blamed myself for not being the same person and felt so horrible that I wasn't the same person.
How could you blame yourself, Kevin?
You know, we were programmed by the Army to be strong and to be these invincible people who can handle anything. And if we had a problem, we were considered to be weak. And the Army instilled in us that, you know, we're not supposed to be that way. One of the hardest things, you know, I had to hear when I came back was, you know, when my wife said to me that, "You're not the man I married. You're not the man I fell in love with." And, you know, my wife said that she had to learn to fall in love with a whole new person again. That hurt a lot. But at the same time, I could understand where she coming from.
Adrian, is it true you've fallen in love with the Kevin Snow of today?
It's taken a lot of work, but yes, we are, you know, our marriage is so much better now because I think a lot of it is I know I've let go of a lot of the, well, this is how my life is supposed to be. You know, Disney creates this fairy tale of the happily ever after. And, you know, when you're a little girl, that's all you want. And you forget that things happen. And, you know, we, you know, last year we were on the verge of a divorce. There's an organization that sends wounded warriors and their spouses to remote Alaska. And, you know, we went there and we were like, when we get back, we're getting a divorce. And this was last June. There was a lot to be learned with no cell phones or TV for 7 days. And, you know, that saved our marriage.
Americans do not have the remotest notion of what the reality is. How do you deal with that, Kevin?
A lot of people think it's Hollywood, and it's really not. You know, we see all these military movies, and it's really, you know, and you watch the movies, and it's really not that way in real life. It's really not all glamorous and that Hollywood makes it out to be. War is not glamorous at all.
Your experience needs to be understood by Americans. I think it's the biggest challenge for this country in the 21st century. We got to know you. We got to know what you're going through. We got to know what you've paid. And we got to think about that.
This has been a very harsh learning experience for all of us. When you have to kick and scream and holler and act like a two-year-old just to get your husband into a program that he's asked for 2 years. And then, you know, stuff happens to where, you know, he can't live in the same house as you and your kids. And the VA is calling you saying he doesn't have any place to go. And I'm like, you can't let him come back here. He's your problem. You fix him. I'm laying it at your doorstep. You know, that shouldn't happen. Why is it happening?
Whose fault is it, Kevin, that you got to the point where you actually assaulted your wife?
I'm not going to sit here and say, it wasn't my fault at all. I do take, you know, half the blame for what happened, because if I wouldn't have stopped taking my meds, it wouldn't have happened. I get to a point where, you know, I get sick of taking meds, and I just don't want to take meds anymore. For 2 years, I did plead with the VA to put me in a program. And, you know, one of the VA's answers on why I couldn't go to a program was, well, you're on a certain med. Well, you put me on that med. Your doctors at the VA prescribed me that med. How are you saying I can't be in your program? You know, I didn't want, you know, that to happen and me to get arrested in front of my children and my wife. That was pretty much me at the bottom of the barrel. And there's only one way that I could go from there, and that is, you know, go up. And I spent the time to get better after that. They did finally put me in a program, and, you know, it's only supposed to be 7 weeks. And they recommend that, you know, if a therapist recommends that you stay longer, it's ultimately up to you. But, you know, I decided to listen to the therapist, and I stayed longer. So, you know, instead of doing only 7 weeks like the program originally is, I did 11 weeks.
A lot of people don't learn that, Kevin. I mean, a lot of people, whether they've been in the Army or have a brain injury, if they need help with something emotional like that, they don't learn that lesson. So, you know, there may be something wrong with your brain, but there's nothing wrong with your heart.
No, not at all. And, you know, I say this all the time. You know, if it wasn't for my family and the Wounded Warrior Project, I probably would have been dead 5 months ago. they give me, you know, they give me purpose.
Kevin Snow and Adrian, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for letting me share my story.
Iraq War veteran Kevin Snow and his wife Adrian, they spoke to us from WHYY in Philadelphia. There are many paths from a war zone back to civilian life and many institutions tasked with making that transition easier. Charisma James is a decorated two-time combat veteran of the United States Army in Iraq and a mom. She has set her sights on becoming a qualified nurse. El Paso Community College in Texas gave her the chance. El Paso is one of the five schools we've been profiling in our Community College Challenge Series. EPCC, as it's known locally, enrolls over 1,000 veterans like Charisma each semester. The school aims to provide a vital bridge for veterans, helping them to reboot their academics and skill up for new careers and civilian life. Charisma James has faced combat in war zones, but going back to school, she told us, was really scary.
School frightened me. Being in the military for so many years, having a very progressive career in the military, and then kind of coming out and feeling like you have to start from square one again, it's a little frightening. So when I did decide to go back to school, I think the first day I went to El Paso Community College, I was probably just about as nervous as my first day of going to basic training.
What's the toughest thing, do you think, about El Paso Community College, your biggest challenge?
Just balancing it all, being a student, studying, you know, home life. But at the same time, my children, they're 4 and 5. They're young and they're going to school. And it's kind of cool to say to them, like, well, mommy's going to school, too, and kind of can be that example, that role model for them.
Well, that's great. What's your dream and how does El Paso contribute to your hopes for the future?
I do want to complete my nursing degree, obtain my BSN. What I like about that is the possibilities in nursing are endless. I can pursue higher degrees. There's so many different disciplines and maybe specializing with domestic abuse. I was thinking about becoming a sexual assault advocate. I know there's some RNs in the city right now that are doing that and maybe, you know, something to do with substance abuse and things of that nature, because El Paso has high rates for both of those things. So I would like to try to contribute to being a solution in the community.
Has that been an issue in your life?
It has. I grew up as a child of a parent that had a substance abuse problem. So it has touched my life in a personal level. So I want to get to a point where I don't have to see people struggle as the way that I've seen them struggle in my life as a child and not being able to do anything about it. And now, you know, I have an opportunity in life where I can help.
How does El Paso have specialized programs to help with the transition from military life to civilian life?
El Paso Community College is currently opening a Veterans Resource Center. So it's supposed to be a one-stop shop for veteran students. So from the moment they walk in the doors at El Paso Community College to their transitioning point, a lot of veteran students, you know, like myself, we come back into the academic arena and, you know, we've been out of school for so long, so we may be rusty in English or math skills. They will be taken care of by specialized caseworkers that can help them in an array of things.
How has the notion of the value of your degree changed as you've been at school?
It took a while to kind of figure out what degree to pursue. When you're in the military, you know, you do feel like you have a sense of purpose. And then when you get out, it's kind of like being a pro athlete and being at the top of your game. And then you retire and it's like, well, what do I do now? You know, so it kind of feels the same way. And so I do have a nurturing soul, I believe. I always want to help people. And so just talking to my family members, I said, you know, I think this would be a good route. I think I can do this. I think this is something that'll interest me. There's unlimited opportunities in this field. I will be helping people. And it just really appealed to me. I feel like it would give me a renowned sense of purpose.
Congratulations, Charisma.
Thank you so much.
U.S. Army veteran Charisma James is attending Texas Tech University's nursing program to pursue an accelerated Bachelor of Science.
Justice Antonin Scalia's death in mid-February has placed the theoretically politically neutral Supreme Court smack in the middle of the bitter partisan politics of 2016 as Republican congressional leaders have steadfastly refused to hold hearings to nominate the man President Obama has chosen to replace Scalia, Chief Judge Merrick Garland. How has Republicans' refusal to consider Garland for the highest court in the land affected the court itself? And what impact has it had on the types and number of cases that the justices have decided to take for the next term? Here to discuss all this is Amy Howe, editor and reporter at SCOTUS Blog.
They are on the home stretch now, trying to finish up and decide all of the cases in which they heard oral argument before their summer recess starts at the end of June.
The New York Times had a piece recently which suggested that the court was diminished, that the loss of Justice Scalia and the whole political machinations associated with the nominee that the Senate refuses to hold hearings for, that that was all the net effect of it is to diminish the court. Any sense of that? Do people believe that? Do people think that's the case?
I think that there may well be. And Ted Olson, the former Solicitor General in the George W. Bush administration, had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal where he proposed sort of a ceasefire, that the Republicans will go ahead and the Democrats will agree that they will confirm well-qualified nominees, that we're not going to make this political, because his point was is that if someone like John Roberts and Elena Kagan and Sam Alito and Sonia Sotomayor are only approved by these very divided votes, that every single appointment is going to become politicized and people are going to have less respect for the court. And then you see a little bit in the sense of the court is not necessarily deciding the big cases. I think three out of every four headlines or first paragraphs in the stories that covered the courts sending these birth control mandate cases back to the lower courts used the word punted, that they're not deciding the big questions right now because they're simply not able to.
Among the cases that are still under consideration and that we'll hear about before the end of the term, are there any big issues that either are likely to be postponed or actually decided?
There are two cases. The first is a case that the Supreme Court almost certainly will decide. It's called Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin. It's a challenge to the university's consideration of race in its undergraduate admissions process. And so the reason that the court will almost certainly decide this case is because Justice Elena Kagan is recused for the case. The justices don't say why they're not participating in the case, but we assume that it's because she was involved in the case when she was actually the Solicitor General of the United States, because the United States has been supporting the university in the Supreme Court and the lower court proceedings as well. And so it was an 8-member court that heard the case back in December, but with the death of Justice Scalia, so that created the possibility for deadlock. But with the death of Justice Scalia, we're now down to a 7-member court. So it seems likely that the court will decide whether or not the university's use of race passes constitutional muster. It's not clear sort of how broad or narrow this decision will be, given that there is a 4-member court. The justices are also well aware that there are affirmative action challenges in the lower court, sort of in the pipeline, heading toward the Supreme Court, involving the use of race at the University of North Carolina, my alma mater, and at Harvard University. And so those cases could make their way to the Supreme Court, and perhaps the Supreme Court could decide it, you know, with Justice Kagan and perhaps even a ninth justice participating someday.
Is there any evidence that the court is paying much attention to the colorful, shall we say, election campaign 2016, the polls, any of the implications of the election that might have an impact on the court?
You know, it's not clear that they're paying attention to the presidential election as such. I'm sure that they are, just like the rest of us. You know, that they are, for the most part, sort of out and about in Washington on a fairly regular basis. But they are, I imagine, are certainly paying attention to the nomination process. And I saw a headline, Justice Stephen Breyer, you know, said, a Justice Samuel Alito, who said that they can get their work done even if they have only 8 members on the court. So I think that they very much want the public to feel like the court is getting things done, that they are functioning, that they're not paying attention to the process.
Amy Howe, editor and reporter at SCOTUS Blog. This is The Takeaway on Memorial Day. I'm John Hockenberry, and some say the Indy 500 is the world's biggest spectator sport. But hey there, the entire city of Washington, D.C. is observing a massive multiplayer game of Veep Stakes.
How's the betting going?
I have not heard from the Trump campaign. Yep.
The speculation about the vice presidency, of course, is flattering.
I have no reason to believe that I'm even being considered. I would have no idea.
And it's her decision, ultimately.
I'm joined now by Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. That's the game in D.C., picking the 2016 running mates, correct?
This is the quadrennial parlor game in Washington and across the country on cable news nets. Who will the candidates pick? And there are all kinds of, well, wrinkles in this game this year because of the unknowns of Donald Trump, the unconventional candidate. Do you want to sort of go down the list, John?
Anyone can play. Is that right?
Let's talk about Chris Christie at the top. He was out early for Donald Trump right after he lost in the primary. He endorsed Donald Trump, came out on stage with him, and made a lot of people speculate that Chris Christie wants to be nominated. John Kasich, also the governor of Ohio, who stuck in the race for a long time, a conservative, thought by some people to be able to give Donald Trump some geographical cred in the swing state of Ohio and also some conservative cred. You've got a couple of other people. Mary Fallon is the governor of Oklahoma. A woman, of course, just vetoed a draconian abortion bill and sparked more speculation that she might be trying to be more palatable to independent and swing voters out there. Jan Brewer of Arizona, she's tough on immigration. She might be a choice too. But John, Donald Trump needs some national security cred. He doesn't have any experience in that. And that's made some people look towards senators like Jeff Sessions, who's on the Armed Services Committee and an advisor to Donald Trump, and also to Bob Corker from Tennessee, who's chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. And lots of people, including me, have been running up to Bob Corker to find out if he's interested.
I have no reason to believe that I'm even being considered. I would have no idea. I get the sense that I don't even know if they've begun to think fully through those kind of things, but I just don't know. But I'm certainly have no knowledge myself.
Have no knowledge.
John, part of this parlor game is to say that you're comfortable in your job, you have no knowledge of it, you've never been contacted. You can't be too eager. And that's why you heard that montage at the top of a bunch of senators and congresspeople and everybody else saying they haven't heard it, they don't know it, they're not interested. Because if you're too eager, you can't get the job, right? You heard also from Joni Ernst. She's the Republican freshman senator from Iowa. She's a woman. She's a conservative. She's a military veteran. She's not interested. She hasn't talked to Donald Trump about it. And just a couple other outside picks just to keep in the back of your mind. How about Newt Gingrich? He's interested in the job. He's said openly that he would take the job if it was offered to him. And what about Joe Arpaio, the anti-immigrant sheriff of Maricopa County? He gets on TV a lot. Outside pick. Outside pick. One in a thousand.
Yeah, one in a million.
But there are some of your top picks for the Republican parlor game there, John.
Well, let's spin the Democratic wheel, shall we?
Absolutely. Now, the parlor game is a little more confined in Hillary land because she's such a traditional politician. So people are looking for more traditional candidates in her candidacy. And a lot of this for her is going to depend on who Trump picks over the summer. But let's start with some of the obvious choices. Julian Castro is the HUD secretary. He has a brother who's also in Congress. He's Latino. He's from Texas. He's young. He's popular. And he's got great demographics. Deval Patrick, the liberal former governor of Massachusetts. He's African American. And Tom Perez, labor secretary currently in the Obama administration, gets quite a lot of buzz for Hillary. But there are a couple of other people, John, who get major buzz for Hillary, but they've got some problems. Here's the obvious choice that a lot of liberals on the left, including Bernie Sanders himself, have said that they might think would be a good choice, Elizabeth Warren.
What kind of a man does that? I'll tell you exactly what kind of a man does that. It is a man who cares about no one but himself.
John, that's Elizabeth Warren at a charity event in Washington just last week. Why do people love her? She gives Hillary Clinton access to a part of the electorate that she's been hurting in the race with Bernie Sanders. Liberals, young voters, young women, anti-Wall Street Democrats, people who Hillary has trouble with. Elizabeth Warren shores that up for her potentially. She's great on the internet. She's a huge fundraiser. You heard in that tape right there, she was talking about Donald Trump, of course. She's made a lot of hay, both behind microphones and on Twitter, for playing the attack dog role, going after Donald Trump. And she hasn't endorsed any candidates in this race. And that's pricked up a lot of ears around here about the potential for an Elizabeth Warren vice presidential candidate. And then you also have Sherrod Brown, the liberal Democratic pro-labor, pro-union senator from Ohio.
I've had no substantive conversations with the nominee, with the prospective nominee. I, I love this job. I don't aspire to be Vice President of the United States. I'm honored to get to fight for the overtime rule that we just handed down, Department of Labor, and the Earned Income Tax Credit, and all the things that with the steelworker jobs in Ohio, all that.
Isn't there a double-edged sword if you're talking about people in the Senate moving over to become somebody's running mate because the Senate is perhaps in play?
No, there's no question about it. Now, here's the problem with both Warren and Sherrod Brown. They'd both be great candidates for Hillary, but they both come from states with Republican governors. If they run for VP, those Republican governors get to appoint Republicans to the seat, and Democrats are trying to take back the Senate. Here's John Tester. He's a senator from Montana, but he's also in charge of winning that race to take back the Senate. And you can hear in his voice, he likes Warren and he likes Sherrod Brown, but he doesn't want either of them to go.
I'm a big Sherrod Brown fan. I say it in somewhat jokingly way, but truth is, Sherrod and I are good friends, and it has a Republican governor in the state of Ohio, so it probably wouldn't be good for the body, but I think he'd bring a nice mix to the ticket.
And Warren?
Well, I don't know. Is the country ready for two women? I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Is the country ready for two women? Has he ever watched the Golden Globes?
Well, you can see a colored political analysis there from a guy whose job it is to help Democrats take back the Senate. And it makes sense why he doesn't want Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown plucked out from his incumbents list.
Well, it goes beyond Capitol Hill. There, I saw John Hickenlooper from Colorado, the governor, on the talk shows on MSNBC. He's got a memoir. Oh, isn't that convenient? Out in 2016. Doesn't that signal that they're maybe looking to be a vice president?
Hickenlooper has made all the appropriate denials that it's not going to happen, that he's not interested. He has that book out. He's keeping a high profile, and he's from an important swing state in the Intermountain West that geographically would be important for Hillary. The question there is whether she goes with that geographical choice or more of a constituency choice, somebody like Elizabeth Warren. I don't think those decisions have been made yet, but you can see all the calculations that go on that fuel this parlor game that we all love to play so much.
Todd Zwillick, our resident historian and Washington correspondent. Thank you so much.
You got it, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home and business, and in-store print shops offering customized presentations, booklets, and manuals in-store and online. Staples, make more happen.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
58,220 Americans died during the Vietnam War. Today, 1,621 Americans are still officially designated as missing and unaccounted for. One of those is Tech Sergeant Melvin Holland. Mel, as he was known to family and friends, was on a top-secret mission in Laos during the Vietnam War. His wife, Anne Holland, remembers well the moment she found out he was missing.
Middle of my Cub Scout meeting with eight little Cubs there, I get this phone call. They said that the hill had been overrun and my husband was missing. Hung up the phone and I knew my life had been destroyed, and I had to turn around and face my eight Cub Scouts and my own five kids. And when the Cub Scouts went home, I had to fix dinner for the kids. And every day it was that way. I mean, the life had gone out of me, but I couldn't say anything to my kids. Every day they'd want to know if we got a letter from Daddy, and I'd pick up an old letter and pretend to read it.
That's because the fate of her husband was a military secret. The Laos mission was secret, so therefore Mel Holland's fate was a secret. According to Patricia Murphy, military and veterans affairs reporter for member station KUOW in Seattle, this complicated the tragedy for a family.
This was unusually cruel for Anne Holland. This mission began with a secrecy agreement that she then was told she needed to keep in place after that phone call. She was told that if he was alive, keeping this secret could mean the fact that he stayed alive, that she could tell no one because it would cause his death.
Except that in the sort of history subsequently, the Nixon administration was much more concerned about her telling that to perhaps some reporter in the Pacific Northwest than they were concerned that she would tip off some Laotian, right?
That was actually the breaking point for her. She kept this secret faithfully, in accordance with her agreement and with the hopes that her husband would be found, that the U.S. government was actually looking for him. And then Nixon made that very public declaration that no one had been killed in ground combat in Laos. And she looked down at the death certificate, which had been issued just a few months before, part of a procedural thing, she was told, and said, "They've forgotten about my husband. They're either lying to cover it up or they've forgotten about my husband." And that's when she picked up the phone.
On March 11th, 1970, 2 years to the day after I was told my husband was missing, President Nixon came on TV and said we'd never lost any men in ground combat in Laos. 2 years to the day. I called up the reporter in Longview and I said, "Well, that's funny because I've got a death certificate that says my husband was killed in ground combat in Laos."
How did telling that information create the momentum to possibly learn more?
Well, it was interesting at the time because that reporter was at her doorstep the next morning, and it created a series of articles about this event, and it also alerted the other wives that somebody was talking about this. Many articles were written. A book was even written. Anne Holland ended up suing the U.S. government at one point to try to find out what happened to her husband. The suit was eventually dismissed after rolling through the courts for many, many years. It was eventually dismissed. But through that lawsuit, a lot of those interrogatories had to be answered, and some of that mission was declassified.
Is this a story about information withheld by the governments in Southeast Asia or information withheld by the U.S. government?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. The U.S. government certainly had a secret mission that it needed to execute. There were reasons that they still see fit to not reveal the particulars of that mission. Meantime, you know, Laos was supposed to be neutral during the war. There was never supposed to be anything going on like this. So recovery efforts there have been very challenging. At a recent briefing by the Department of Defense for families who have prisoners of war missing, killed in action, body not recovered, it's explained to them quite thoroughly that the politics of the nations and the countries, rather, that we are trying to search in to get the answers for them are very complicated. And Laos has a corruption problem that complicates the mission of recovery.
What's the chance that, you know, like so many of these stories, and there are millions of missing Vietnamese from that conflict, mm-hmm. that he's just sort of lost in the massive forces that, you know, moved mountains and forests and villages and killed so many people in that war, and that, you know, there's nothing to hide because there's just nothing possible to find in the chaos of war?
That is certainly a possibility that Anne Holland has thought about. She's also thought about other possibilities, and this is a popular one with folks who have people who are MIA from Vietnam. Her husband had specialized knowledge. He was an electronics expert. There is a theory that he was taken by the Russians because of his specialized knowledge. That theory exists in a lot of families who have MIAs from Vietnam. I should say that Mel Holland's disappearance was very difficult on the family, not just on Anne Holland, his wife, but on his children. Her pursuit of this truth broke up her family in various ways over the years.
Patricia Murphy, military veterans reporter from KOW in Seattle. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Patricia Murphy, military and veterans affairs reporter for member station KUOW. Her story about Tech Sergeant Melvin Holland was produced as part of the American Homefront Project, a collaboration of KUOW, WUNC, and Southern California Public Radio.
And here's something to take with you on this holiday. There are lots of Memorial Day sales in America today. I'm sure you've noticed, right?
cars.
Today is a great day to lease a new 2016 Chevy Trax or Equinox for just $129 a month. Or purchase and save $5,000.
Mattresses.
It's Memorial Day madness only at the Mattress Hub. Huge savings store-wide from your locally owned mattress expert.
Cars.
During the giant Memorial Day sales event, I'm slashing over 800 vehicles. If you're another dealer, you might want to take the weekend off.
Furniture.
Save on every sofa, every table, every chair, or every mattress.
Spas.
Featuring hot spring spas with interest-free financing. No payments for 5 months and a free Ace Salt system with select hot spring purchases.
And cars. Well, RVs, I guess.
You want to make moments with your family, but you don't want to spend their college savings. This is the ride.
But I wanted to know, what is the absolute largest Memorial Day sale in American history? The biggest, the largest. So just Google, right? Biggest Memorial Day sale in history. There we go. There are only 3,090,000 candidates. 3,090,000. That's all. Free enterprise. It's a beautiful thing. Have a great holiday, however you signify it. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding research so patients do more than survive, they live their lives. Learn more at lls.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI. Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.